there? This is our low-tech specialty. Okay. I think the first place to start with the whole issue of reforms that will help prevent eyewitness misidentifications is to realize that we're really not writing on a clean slate. A lot has gone into this. It really started in 1999 when an interdisciplinary group was pulled together by the Department of Justice and came up with a set of recommendations called Eyewitness Evidence, a Guide for Law Enforcement. Then, by September of 2003, NIJ created a trainer's manual that was available to all members of law enforcement in the country on how to implement this. Recently, the International Association of Chiefs of Police developed a training key on eyewitness identification. And most recently, the FBI published something called Violent Encounters, which was a handbook on violent crime, and they sort of updated the eyewitness identification procedures. As I mentioned, the California Commission on the Fair Administration of Justice, you can go look at their website for their study. The Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I think, Rose, we distributed, you should have, I included the Wisconsin Attorney General's guidelines. That was a very, I forgot to mention that one, because they had a statewide commission that issued guidelines in the area of eyewitness identification that, again, was all judiciary, prosecutors, police, defense, academia getting together, and they issued these guidelines that you have. And the reason that I distributed them is it has a very clear and extensive discussion of the folder method, which is a low-tech way to do double-blind administration of a photo array. So that's perhaps the principal reason I distributed that one. Then we have the American Bar Association itself issued a long report that came out of the criminal justice section, which again has prosecutors, defense judges on it, but it was adopted by the big ABA. Those of you that are active in the American Bar Association knows it's not a trivial matter to get something adopted by the big ABA. And then, of course, there are the New Jersey Attorney General guidelines, as I mentioned in the morning. New Jersey has been in this business now for close to 7-8 years. And there are, here, very simply, is, and again, these are system variables. The reason that these should be stressed so much is that there's been 30 years of very elegant social science research, primarily in the area of psychology, that looked at things that, you know, there are event and witness variables, you know, who knows, there may be stress, it could be a cross-racial identification, there could be weapon focus, there could be all kinds of things that are peculiar to the actual event. But there are other things, system variables, which are peculiarly within the purview of the court, and this area of research is very important because they're able to do all kinds of studies and just manipulate the way that identification procedures are conducted in order to see what results you get and which are more reliable than the others. So, for example, all of the best practices and guidelines that I've shown you all recommend, and you know, all of them, sometimes they have mandatory, sometimes they have preferred, but all of them start, for example, with the warning. In fact, it was Professor Roy Malpass from the University of Texas at El Paso that actually did the major research in this area. And that is, if you literally tell a witness before a photo array or a lineup, the real assailant may not be in this photo array or in this lineup. If you don't select anybody, don't worry, the investigation will continue. If you just give that warning, it reduces incorrect identifications by a statistically significant amount without reducing correct ones, which is, of course, a win-win. And the reason for that, you know, is that people in these kinds of situations naturally have a desire to get closure. I think the police must have the right guy, otherwise why would they be there to look at photos? You know, they want it to end for all kinds of reasons, and they might tend to guess or pick the person that they think most resembles the person who really committed the crime. So that warning has been found to reduce mistakes without reducing correct identifications. Fillers. Select the fillers, you know, people that aren't the assailant, based on the description given by the witness, not based on resemblance to the suspect. And again, the studies show that that reduces error without reduces correct identification. A certainty statement, preferably in the words of the witness at the time of the identification. It's not very much appreciated, but if you go back to Wade Gilbert Stovall and Manson v. Braithwaite and Neal v. Biggers, the element, the reliability factor of certainty, the courts are very clear. It's certainty at the time of the identification. All the studies have shown that if you get a certainty statement after the identification, it tends to be not correlated with accuracy or reliability. There is some correlation between reliability and certainty statement as long as you get it at the time of the identification. And police, I think, prefer to get it in the words of the witness. It's a very bad idea, in my judgment, and judgment of most of law enforcement, to say, well, give me an estimate of how sure you are on a scale of 1 to 10. You know, because somebody could be completely sure, and they'll say 9, just because, you know, nobody feels absolutely certain of everything. And then all of a sudden, the defense lawyer gets up there and says, you know, that's a reasonable doubt, right? It's only 9 out of 10. So a certainty statement in the words of the witness is the accepted best practice. Everybody goes for that. Some form of documentation really should be done of the identification procedures, whether it's a videotaping or audio taping, so you have a record of exactly what happens. And here's the big one, and probably the most important reform of all, that the identification procedure should be double blind. That is, preferably, the person who is administering the photo array, the lineup, should not know who the suspect is. And the importance of that is not that police are cheating or stealing, you know, steering people improperly on purpose, although that can happen, but because there are signals, body language, and just impulses that any human has. You know, you made the case, you got your suspect, now you're showing the photo array, and the witness starts going for the one you think, you jump up. If they go for the one you don't think, you know, you're not as enthusiastic, and that, particularly if the officer has rapport with the witness, is picked up. I think one of the best examples is the Thomas McGowan case, which was one of the exonerations we just had, 3 months ago, in Dallas. It's a very interesting case. How many years, Mike, did McGowan do?
Since 80.
Yeah, so he was a 24-year prison term. And what happened to McGowan is that when the victim was shown the photos, she said, I think it's number 3, or whatever the number was. I think it's number 3. And the detective said, no, you can't be uncertain. You have to be sure. Either it's him or not. Okay? And she said, okay, it's number 3. Boom, 23 years in jail for a crime he didn't commit. Now, and we identified the person who really did commit the crime. Now, what's interesting about that, if the examiner was blinded, didn't know who the suspect was, the officer never would have done that, because on the face of it, it kind of seems reasonable. You don't want to go with somebody that really isn't sure, right? But the only reason that the officer understandably was saying, well, you got to be sure one way or the other, right? Either it's him, you have to select or not. If the officer had knew, or if that person had been a filler, that photograph wasn't the suspect, had been a filler, the officer never would have said, oh, you got to be sure one way or the other, right? Because the witness would be pointing to somebody that the officer knew was not the suspect, right? So the natural inclination, if they say, I'm not sure, would be, okay, there's a reason you're not sure, that can't be the guy. Let's move on to the next photo array. So blinded administration helps in every way, in terms of taking certainty statements, in terms of just the whole process. And of course, it's good science. I mean, there is no scientific discipline where you wouldn't do a procedure like this as much as possible in a double-blinded fashion for independent examination. So I think double-blind administration is critical in importance. Obviously, as we'll talk in a minute, The sticking point there, I really believe, is the ease of administration. Can we really do this with police departments in a way that, without overtaxing personnel and running up budgets and creating chaos for the court system? I think that's the primary concern in the final analysis. And then there's the issue of whether or not the photos of the individuals in a corporeal lineup should be shown sequentially one at a time versus simultaneously altogether. And the laboratory research has shown that a sequential presentation reduces mistakes considerably, and there's some slight diminution, statistically significant, in correct identification. So that's kind of a policy choice. But even more importantly, I mentioned the Illinois Ryan reports. One of the bills that was passed was a pilot project bill to do a field study on sequential versus simultaneous presentation, the eyewitness reforms. And that was done in Chicago with the police, the Catsuits Police Department, Sherry Mecklenburg. Sometimes it's called the Mecklenburg study. And the results of that study were problematic because there were some fundamental scientific problems in the way they went about it, because they were compared non-blind sequential presentation, the way officers just ordinarily do it, to the double-blind presentation that would be sequential. And so they didn't study simultaneous non-blind, sequential non-blind. They didn't have like four cells to do it. And there is something that's a problem even looking at the doing an experiment with non-blind the way we do it against other procedures. There was a lot of controversy about the results of this report because, all of a sudden, unfortunately, ordinarily you get a very considerable number of fillers that are picked, right? And there were virtually no fillers picked in the non-blind simultaneous presentation. So the concern was somebody said, I think it's number two in the study, and they said if they knew it was a filler, they said, well, I guess you're not sure. And if they thought it was a suspect, they said, yeah, number two, which is kind of the way sometimes these things happen, even among the most well-intentioned of officers. So there was a bunch of Nobel Prize-winning psychologists published an article criticizing the scientific methodology, and everybody agreed in Chicago, and I must say I was involved in the convening of that in the first place, that more studies were necessary. So what happened is that we went to Greensboro, North Carolina. The American Judicature Society convened a group, and we got all the scientists in this field together on both sides of the issue of whether sequential would be better or simultaneous would be better, and tried to come up with a way to test this. And so that we would really get a result, because it seemed very important for the policing community to know whether sequential or simultaneous was the better way to go about it, and we really needed a good scientific answer. One of the problems, incidentally, with the sequential-simultaneous controversy is that all the other best practices that nobody's disputing, that everybody recommends in law enforcement and the bars, all those sort of got thrown out with the bathwater, right? So, I mean, there's no reason not to implement giving the warning, picking the fillers according to the description, getting a certainty statement in the words of the witness. All those other reforms are the accepted best practices within the law enforcement and the scientific community, but there is controversy over the sequential versus simultaneous. So the idea is that we wanted to figure out a way to get an answer. And that's actually a pretty good precedent generally in the criminal justice system, because we don't often go out and try to do a real scientific experiment in order to change procedures based on the results. So that it seemed like a good precedent to do that as well. So all the scientists got together and came up with the idea that the best way to go about doing this was to get a laptop computer and do the photo presentations with a laptop computer, because that way we get very good records of what happened. We're able to preserve everything very carefully. We get exactly what photos were shown. It's a very simple matter to do an audio recording or a video recording, frankly, of the identification procedure. It's pretty easy to do it in a blinded fashion. And you get very, very good results. And we would do some sequentially, some simultaneously. So the American Judicature Society, the John Jay School of Criminal Justice in New York, a police organization in Wisconsin, national one, I can't remember, and the Innocence Project all got together and with all the scientists, and we created a protocol for trying to test this. And in the course of it, became convinced that one of the really good ways to implement eyewitness reform is the use of these laptop computers. And we've already started to do it. We had a dry run in Charlotte, North Carolina. It got cut short because the legislature passed a bill, as I mentioned before, saying that all identification procedures had to be done sequential and blind after the Duke LaCrosse case, so we could no longer test it blind simultaneous because the statute precluded it. So we got in about 100 identifications there. We just started this process in Tucson, Arizona, and there the terrific group of people in the police department, Council Police Department, Lisa Judges, and the police are a driving force behind it. And interestingly, it's probably too much of a diversion, but you remember the case Arizona versus Youngblood? That was where, you know, there was a rape kit that was destroyed, and the Arizona Supreme Court voted that the destruction of the evidence meant that the prosecution had to be dismissed. Went to the United States Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled you can't just balance these kinds of things. You have to have a per se rule that only if the evidence is destroyed in bad faith will there be a suppression. Okay? It was remanded back to the Arizona Supreme Court. They reconsidered it on state constitutional grounds, and 3-2, they voted to go with the United States Supreme Court rule in Youngblood versus Arizona. So Youngblood goes to prison. He goes to prison for 19 years. Then he is released as a sex offender. He is reporting back as a sex offender, and he violates his reporting requirements. So he's back in jail, and the attorney that's representing him goes out and tries to look again for the vaginal swabs, right, and the rape kit in the case, and they find it, okay? And they found it, and they did a DNA test, and they've exonerated Youngblood and identified the person who really committed the crime. So the detective in Tucson, Arizona, who did the Youngblood case, is the one that is actually leading the way here in working with the laptop computer. So Tucson, Arizona now is doing all their identification procedures in all cases with the laptop computers and, of course, participating in this experiment. We have been talking, of course, with our friends in Dallas about working on this. The city of Detroit wants to do it, St. Louis, San Francisco, Hillsborough, Tampa, Hillsborough Sheriff's Department, Florida. We have some considerable amount of money to test this and the leading scientists. The other criticism of the Chicago study is that there was no follow-up on what happened to the case. Because what happens if you pick somebody? That's the suspect. Is the person guilty or not? Well, obviously, there's no way to get to ground truth in these situations. We're never going to know, perhaps a DNA test, but we can't get all these cases just on single perpetrator rapes. We wouldn't get enough of what they call the end. We wouldn't have enough identifications, really, to get a sound scientific result. So what we've done instead is that, working with a group called the Police Foundation, we've got a group of prosecutors, defense lawyers, judges, police together. We've come up with kind of an instrument to make an evaluation of a case, because if somebody is identified and then they dismiss the case, it doesn't mean the guy's innocent. It could be that the witness fled to Tijuana, right? And that's why the case was dismissed. On the other hand, somebody could take a plea and it could be part of a package deal, and, you know, this wasn't the strong case, it was the weak case, but the person took the plea because of all the other time they were facing. So we wanted to see if we could come up with a set of variables that would indicate whether a case was strong or not so strong. And we think we have that instrument and, you know, pre-decided, and then we have teams in each of these different jurisdictions that will evaluate the case in cooperation with the district attorney's office and the police department. And we'll be looking at a lot of these dismissals and guilty pleas. And also, we should be able to track what you might characterize as a correct or incorrect rejection. Because let's say that somebody doesn't pick out the suspect, but then another witness does, where you come up with, I don't know, a fingerprint or DNA evidence that shows that the person that wasn't selected was really the guilty party, that would be an incorrect rejection. Or there could be correct rejections. Somebody doesn't pick the suspect, the case goes away, and then you find the real perpetrator. So we want to do these studies in a longitudinal way in order to get to the bottom of that issue. I would, given the pace in which we're going, I don't think that we're going to get results out of these for another, 2 years. We've been trying to work with the National Institute of Justice because they had put out a grant on this so that we could all have one large combined study, but I'm not sure that is going to work out. Now, I want to emphasize again that in terms of the best practices, right, that have been recommended by everybody, and remember I'm making the caveat about sequential versus simultaneous, but I'm talking about the warnings, filler selection, double blind, documenting the identification procedure, certainly statements in the name of the witness. The state of Wisconsin, as you can see from the guidelines, does it. The state of New Jersey has been doing it for years. In Minnesota, Hennepin County and Ramsey County, and incidentally, one of the people that's written in this area we've worked very closely with is the newly elected senator from the state of Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar, who for many years was the prosecutor in Minneapolis. Is a big proponent of these issues. Massachusetts, all the prosecutors in Massachusetts have issued guidelines adopting all the practices, including sequential blind, although there's been some implementation issues. But one of the best ones was Northampton, Massachusetts. And there's an officer there, Ken Patnav, who was on the original NIJ commission, who's the one that developed the folder method, which I'll describe, show you in a second. And then, of course, Santa Clara, California. This is being done, I think, increasingly everywhere. So, how do you do it? How do you do a sequential blind identification procedure, low-tech, in a small police department, right? Well, you literally take out folders. If you're going to do it sequentially, there's a kind of a rule that the first photo in shouldn't be the suspect, but that for technical reasons. But you would get a series of folders, okay, and you would have one that you put aside that has the first picture that you know is a killer, and then you would have two more in the end that are folders, and then you get another five or six that you would contain the suspect and other fillers. And you literally just mix those up. So you don't know which one is coming next. Now, obviously, if you have a blinded administrator, the detective who's working the case and picks the fillers and arranges everything can create these folders and then just give it to the blinded administrator who mixes up the folders and then presents it to the witness. And the witness opens up the folder one at a time like that. Or if you're really short on personnel and you can't have somebody who would serve as the blinded administrator go out, if you have some kind of an audio or video documentation, witness of some kind, the officer who's doing the whole thing can do the folder shuffle method, and you still get a blinded administration because when they say it's in this folder, and they get a certainty statement in the name of the witness, the person administering it doesn't know whether the photo in this folder is a suspect or a filler. That's one way that it's worked. You can just have some blinded administrator take out a photo array, doesn't know who the suspect is, and that's done all the time in New Jersey and all these other jurisdictions, and they haven't found it to be an administrative problem, and you can certainly talk to all of them, but they're doing it low-tech. That's the low-tech way of doing it, and it works pretty well. So here is what has been developed by this working group that I've described. I'm going to try this, see how this works. There's all kinds of confidential and proprietary information, and I want you to know that the people that do this, who help work on designing, work with us, work with the scientists and the lawyers and the judges and everybody in putting together this lineup procedure software program. We have no financial interest in this group. And the best thing in the criminal justice community is if you get a lot of people in who would be competitors and would have, offer the software from different places in different forms. That's the best thing, to have that kind of competition. And I'm sure that will happen. But in any event, this is confidential proprietary information, so I couldn't show you a live one, but I can show you a series of slides of this software program. So the way it works is, and you know, I'm sure all departments have this, is that you have your own, you know, document system, right? And so this lineup procedure is just going to be patched into your current computerized system for collecting information in the police department. There are also, and this is one tremendous value, there are also, you can patch into a digitized photo bank, right? In various different parts of Texas and all across the country, and I'm sure soon they'll be offered nationwide, that will help in filler selection, as I'll show. So this is basically the way it works. You have the detective who works the case, and the detective who works the case has the laptop, and that will be connected to the police department network server. The server will also be a source of the photos for the suspect and for the fillers. The network is going to be able to store the lineup that was created immediately in a PDF and a WAV file. A WAV file is the sound file, which, as I'll show you in a minute, you know, is terrific for presenting this in court and for preserving the integrity of the evidence. The lineups themselves can be accessible from all kinds of different laptops, and you can upload the storage of the lineup data and the WAV file, the sound file, right away into the server. After the administration of a lineup to a witness, a reconnection to the server uploads the results immediately, full records back to the police department. And, you know, you can really time it. You know, there's the witness. It's got a time date. The witness goes through the procedure. You get online. You send it. You know, no chance for monkey business at all. Once created and downloaded to the laptop can be taken into the field for administration of the photo lineup. Now, in other words, if you create the lineup at the precinct, you just take the laptop into the field. What we found, for example, in Tucson, and what I know they would want to do in Houston from talking with the chiefs there, and I think it arose at our criminal justice summit, we were talking about this, is that, you know, often detectives will be able to take the laptop, they're, you know, signing out at 4 o'clock, they'll be able to go and visit some witnesses, you know, between 4 and 6, and then go home. They don't have to come back to the precinct. They can just take the laptop with them and send it online, and then you get the results to bring the laptop back the next day. Because it will be stored immediately at the server in the police department. And it also helps in multiple defendant cases, which is one of the problems that arose in Chicago. Because if you have more than multiple witness cases, I should say, or multiple suspect cases, you have to show the same laptop to lots of different people. If you have this kind of computerized system, it assists in making it all a double-blind administration. So here's just a, I don't know if you can see it here, but here's just a form. And what happens is to create a new mugshot photo lineup, complete the information below, click Save to proceed. To reprint the previously created lineup, please use the photo lineup archive module. So here you have lineup Nate Injub lineup, and this one will be done sequentially. And you write in the reason for the lineup, the related case, viewed by, suspect name, and here's all that stuff filled in, if you see. So that's just how the officer would fill it in. And then you can press this option for viewing the photo. So in other words, you go back and you have a suspect, and the suspect is Jane Miller, right? White female, birth date is November 8, 1967, and you want to, you know, get a, she's your suspect, and you want to get her mugshot. So you just go into the archives, you pull the mugshot, the detective confirms that this is the suspect's photo that you're going to use. Go back, input that. Now you then take, and here's the search function. You now can write in that you want the race, a white, female. You can fill in the date of birth, hair color, eye color, etc., in order to find other pictures that can serve as fillers. Okay? Then those automatically come to the detective, and just to see how you would do one of these things, that's our suspect, and here would be the different photos. Can you all see that in the bottom? Here would be the different photos of potential fillers that the detective working the case can see. And the detective can decide, well, you know, I don't really like these fillers. I don't think that they're sufficiently similar. And remember, they should be looking at the description, should be matched to the description. But you also, of course, don't want a filler that, you know, is so different from the suspect that it's an unfair procedure. So the detective who's working the case gets to do this and, you know, put all these different photos into the lineup until he or she is satisfied that this is a good photo array to have the witness look at. So, as I said, you can reject any of the fillers. Okay, here's what you would fill out in terms of actually going out and doing the inputting information about the case. So here we have the witness is John Crutchfield. Here's the description that he gives. You know, white female, approximately 20 years of age, blue jeans, white t-shirt. The race is white. Sex, female. Ethnicity, none that they can think of, age 30. Bystander or victim, witness, bystander. Approximate distance from the perpetrator, 2 feet. Period of observation, 20 seconds. Did the witness receive any information after the event regarding the suspect? No. Have any drinks? Number of drinks, 2. An hour ago, you know, there's something here for drugs, etc. Did the witness encounter the suspect's photo after the crime through a wanted poster, a newspaper, or prior to the lineup? No. Was the witness under influence of drugs or alcohol? Yes, and they list what that was. Does the witness wear corrective lenses? Was the perpetrator previously known by the witness? Did the witness complete a composite prior to the lineup? So you get all that information. That is inputted as well. And incidentally, for these experiments, we're going to have an incredible database to be able to look at, you know, who was selected and who wasn't. And we'll have a lot of information to work with to look at other interesting questions. But that's just something that you would want as law enforcement to have in your files anyhow. It's just the kind of information that would ordinarily go into a police report. But here it is in the computer, immediately downloaded, right there. Okay. So, additional case information, some have the option of doing that. Gives you the crime type, the date, lighting, weather, is there a weapon? Yes, 9mm handgun, number of perpetrators, number of witnesses. Did the witness observe physical violence? If yes, was the physical violence directed at the witness? No. Did the witness observe the crime? Yes. Okay, so you filled all this out. Now your lineup has been saved and may now be downloaded for remote viewing. In other words, you picked the fillers, you filled all the information, you're now ready to take the laptop computer and go out and show it to the witness. And here's what would happen. All right, that's the lineup gets a number here. That's lineup 175 that would be in the system that anybody can access. So I don't know if you can see it here, but that's, you know, in the server, you'd be able to see available lineup. It was created by Detective M.R. King. It's lineup number 175. You have the case number, the description, armed robbery. You can see there it also has files for completed lineups and archives lineups. Everything is in that main server. Okay. All right, another description of that for purposes of the server. Now, you go online. You've got it. Now you want to download the lineup. Here is a sheet that gives you the criminal identification numbers of all the fillers that were picked. So here's a complete record of who's in this lineup. Okay, fill this out for, you know, it's being shown at, you know, precinct, and the lineup administrator is some named individual, and there's something on the language. Okay, here's the part I hope works. You go, begin to show this to the witness. And that before you show it to the witness, the first thing you do, because in order to develop uniformity, and excuse the voice, you can always re-record a different kind of voice, but you want to play the sound, right, to make sure that the sound is working right before you give the computer to the witness. And now you
before viewing the lineup, You will be asked to review a set of instructions. After each instruction, you will be asked if you understand the instruction and wish to continue. Please click Continue to begin. Our lineups never contain more than one suspect. However, one or more persons might be familiar to you for reasons unrelated to the crime. If you indicate that an individual is familiar, you will be asked whether the familiar person is related or unrelated to the crime. The officer may have additional questions for you.
And you see, the witness would then say, yes, I understand these instructions and wish to continue. No, I do not understand these instructions and do not wish to continue. Now, obviously there's concern about whether people are going to be, you know, literate enough or fearful of the computers in order to do this. I mean, we know that they all take money out of cash machines, so there's some hope there, and I guess there's a lot of electronic voting going on today. But obviously if you have a blinded administrator, completely blinded administrator, they can assist the witness if they don't understand any of this, and because this whole proceeding is going to be audio recorded, you know, right by the computer right there, or if it's outfitted, you know, video recorded, you have a complete record of everything that was said to the witness if they're saying, no, I don't understand, what should I do next, blah, 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 blah. So it's all there. Next.
The photos will be displayed to you as a group of six, and you will be asked if any of the individuals look familiar to you. Even if you identify someone, you will be returned to the lineup and asked if any other individuals look familiar.
Now, this is going to be the simultaneous version. Now, I mean, I'm showing this to all of you because, you know, this can be outfitted. You know, if some particular police department here in Texas wants to do this, and it's not being done pursuant to this experiment, you can change a lot of this, right, in accordance with your own specifications. We're doing this in a particular way because we have to have a certain amount of uniformity for the experiments. The other thing that would happen for purposes of the experiments is that the moment that the witness hits a button, whether this is going to be a sequential blind or a simultaneous blind lineup, happens randomly. So there's random assignment of which witnesses are getting the sequential blind versus the simultaneous blind, which and random assignment is scientifically a very important principle in terms of making any of these field studies work. So that's what the witness says.
The photographs will not be in any particular order. You should take as much time as you need to look at the photos. The person who committed the crime may or may not be included. Keep in mind that things like hairstyles, beards, and mustaches can be easily changed, and that complexion colors may look slightly different in photographs.
That's a traditional thing that officers always do say and should say. Why isn't this working? Well, you saw that for some reason the WAV file didn't work, but you saw it's the traditional warning. You don't have to select somebody. Don't worry, the investigation will continue. I'm pressing continue, and it's not working. Come on. Sorry about this. Okay. There's the lineup, and the witness is asked, do any of these individuals look familiar to you? Now, the reason that we say familiar, and again, some departments don't like to do this, some do. For purposes of the experiment, it seemed like the appropriate thing to do. Sometimes when you show photo arrays to a witness, particularly in small towns, they know the people, right? It's my cousin, it's my relative, it's somebody there. So the first question to make sure that you it's really an array of six or five fillers and one suspect, you ask, do they look familiar to you? So if you press yes, then you're told confirm yes, and then you're asked the person who is familiar to you. And come on. There it is. You indicated that this person looks familiar to you. Do you recognize this person for reasons related to the crime or not related to the crime? Okay, so they as you noticed, they picked a filler here. So they say, related to the crime, confirm related to the crime. Then the officer would like to ask you some questions about your response. Please do not proceed until asked to do so by the officer. So, if they pick somebody that is familiar to them and was involved in the crime, related to the crime, you would then want to ask, the officer would ask, well, who was this? How is this person related to the crime? Because remember, you can have more than one person involved in a criminal transaction. So this could have been the guy that held me, and the other person hit me in the mouth. There could be multiple defendants, and so you want to make sure that with some precision you're asking who this is. How do you know this person? How's that person related to the crime? So the officer would ask those questions. And, of course, there would be an audio recording, and the officer could make notes if he or she wanted. But there would be a record of that, and every police department can have their own sort of protocol for what the officer would say in these kinds of situations. Then, for purposes of this experiment, you would go on to ask if any of these other familiar individuals look familiar to you. No, confirm no, end of lineup presentation. Thank you, the lineup process has been completed. The officer will now take control of the computer, right? I guess that's the age we're living in. Then, the lineup administrator, to be completed by the administrator on completion of the lineup. Do you know which image was the suspect? And they'll check off, and were any aspects of the research protocol that could not be followed? If so, explain. So they fill out, no, I didn't know who the suspect was, and were there any issues that could not be followed? They say yes, and they could give some explanation in that box. Here's a record of all the different lineups that are on the computer. As I said, these would immediately be sent online to the server down at police headquarters, and there are two kinds of files, the JPEG file, which is the pictures, and the WAV file, which would be the audio. Okay, this is what it would look like eventually when printed out down at the precinct. This is all the information. Then you'd indicate here, image recognized by witness, it's the filler. Here is, and this is fascinating for research purposes and interesting for others, you have exactly everything that happened printed out automatically, right, by the time. Now, the reason I say this, in eyewitness researchers will tell you that they suspect that, although nobody can quite demonstrate this yet, but reliability is sometimes correlated with speed of identification. The ones that the researchers like the most are the so-called pop-ups, where the person looks at the photos and that's the guy, right? Sometimes when it takes a long time for identification and everybody's studying it, particularly in a simultaneous presentation, there is some concern about how that goes. But who knows? We'll be able to test out that hypothesis as well as others, because we're going to get all that data. Okay? That's our suspect. Now, here's the sequential version. Same initial stuff is filled out, who's doing it when. Here's the sound. Same warning about how the lineups never contain more than one suspect. Oops, come on. Photos will be shown to you now. This is the sequential presentation. The photos will be shown to you one at a time, and you will be asked if the individual is familiar to you. Even if you identify somebody during the procedure, you'll be asked to look at the rest of the photos. And that's the traditional way that sequential should be done, so they don't, you know, they go through the whole process and they can't be anticipating. The photographs will not be in any particular order. It should take as much time as you need to look at the photos. The person who committed the crime may or may not be included. Keep in mind things like hairstyles, beards change. You do not have to make an identification. This procedure is important to the investigation, whether you might identify anybody. Come on. All right, here's the begin. Okay. Does this person look familiar to you? All right? No, confirm no. This person looked familiar to you. No, confirm no. This person? Yes. You indicated that this person looks familiar to you. Do you recognize this person for reasons related to the crime or unrelated to the crime? Checks related to the crime. Confirm that. Now you ask questions. Who was this? The getaway driver, person with the knife, etc. Then they go on to show the rest of them. This person looked familiar. Oops. Confirm this person. Confirm this person. Confirm. Done. And then this is downloaded. Same questions as before. This is what's saved, you see. Down at the precinct, they reproduce each of the different responses. Now, what's important about this is just think about presentation in court, okay? One of the advantages of using the laptop computer is that you only need, when you're putting it into evidence, you only need one police official. And the reason I emphasize this, I guess about 8 or 9 years ago, we made a presentation to Ray Kelly, who's the police chief in New York City. No, it must have been about 7 years ago. Somebody I'd known for a long time, and I had once explained a lot of this on a napkin to him in a bar. Okay, so I thought he was prepped for it, and we did this whole presentation. We show him a thing where you try to identify somebody in a film, and he gets the wrong guy, and all the brass, and everybody liked it. And then Ray says, "Well, how many people do I need to bring it to court?" And we said, "Well, you need the blinded administrator, and you know, maybe if you want, you bring the detective." He goes, "That's it. Come back to me in, you know, a decade. I can't afford that. Because in New York City, everything is gigantic, right? And overtime, days off, bringing officers to courts, it's insane. That place is literally an army. The budget of our city is more than most states." So the laptop changes that. Because the way you get this into evidence, and you have the actual copy of it, let's say the detective who made the photo array testifies. He gets on the witness stand and says, "The way we do our identification procedures here in Houston is that we send somebody out to with a laptop computer. They don't know who the suspect is. It's all recorded. I'm the one who created this photo array. Here it is. You just have a disk, right, that reflects what's on the hard drive. If the defense lawyer wants to go and look at the hard drive, they can. But literally, you just have a disk of everything, both the photos as shown and the sound. Also, you can just introduce into evidence exactly the same size, a replica of the photo arrays, of the photos, whether it's sequential or simultaneous. He said, "I created that array. The procedure is somebody goes out, shows that to the witness who doesn't know who the suspect is, just goes out and does it. Okay, that's taken subject to connection or come into evidence as to what he created." Then the witness testifies. And the witness says, "I was there, I looked at this, yes, I've heard this, that's exactly how it happened, this is who I picked, but boom, it's in." Or you can dispense with the detective who created the array and you just use the blinded administrator. And the blinded administrator testifies to what he showed or she showed, and the witness testifies. So you only need one police officer and a witness. In terms of persuasiveness to juries, I think this has got to be very persuasive. First of all, it follows automatically all the best practices, which can be justified if it's under attack. There's no longer, you're not going to be losing things, and the integrity of the process is really assured by the way that the stuff is sent to the central server and can be reproduced later. I think that works out pretty well. I mentioned some of these features: random assignment, randomization. There's uniformity in all these instructions, so it goes. So that's pretty much how this laptop photo array works. And I think it, all considered, is fairly cheap. There are the expenses of having to get a patch, so that you can get the digitized pictures in. And obviously, there's some start-off costs in terms of training. But in terms of all the other best practices, you don't have to use a laptop computer, although I do think that is the wave of the future. You can just use the folder method. Or you can just conduct a corporeal lineup. But I don't know if there's too many going on here in Texas, are there? I don't think so. I think Most identifications across the country and in the state are done initially by photos. So that's my presentation. Are there any questions about this or comments about this? Yeah.
I just have a couple of quick questions. How does the double-blind sequential take into account, let's say the witness is shown a lineup with a suspect, and then they're brought back a couple of days later, and they're shown a different lineup with the same suspect, and then they're shown a third lineup.
Well, why? But
and the pillars are all different, so that individual's going to look familiar.
Well, I would. One rule in this game is that you wouldn't show the same suspect more than once. In other words, one of the problems, I have to tell you, in New York City, it's a real problem because we have an absurd rule in New York that you can't introduce photos in the prosecution's direct case. So they start the cases by doing photo identifications, and then in order to, they have to then bring people to lineups. And those lineups are worthless. They're no better than the reliability of the original photo identification. This is this phenomenon of mugshot commitment. You know, you'll be remembering the person's photo that you saw before. So for the very reasons that you cite, it would be bad practice and disfavored practice to show the same suspect in more than one photo. They don't pick them out, they don't pick them out. Whether you're doing it simultaneously or sequentially.
Yeah. How much of the problems with eyewitness identification is the bad practices in eyewitness show-ups as opposed to just unreliability of eyewitness identification?
Well, you know, we don't know in the final analysis, but, you know, what we do know, and that's why the Congressman was pointing out before, it's systems. We do know that simple things like giving a warning, you're perpetrating, you're not the other, selecting the photos the right way, following these practices, you will reduce error. Right? How much you reduce error as opposed to just how much you're just going to be mistaken identifications, we don't know. Right? But we know if you can reduce error, and there are variables that are within the control of law enforcement, then it's something that should be done. Just to show you the force of all of this, and this will be arising in court cases, because right now, if you have general best practices, which are accepted by all these law enforcement, you know, groups, and you're the police department that is not following them, believe me, the defense attorney is going to confront the police about why they're not doing it. And some of these practices, because they are system variables and they have a scientific merit to it, are going to be acknowledged by courts. For example, Connecticut Supreme Court in the case for State versus Ledbetter. What happened in Ledbetter is that they didn't give a warning that the real perpetrator may not be in the photo array. Now, the conviction is affirmed for other reasons, but we filed an amicus brief in the Connecticut Supreme Court, and based on the amicus brief and the data, because the data on the warnings is, as I said, it was really not past his original experiment, and they do what they call meta-analyses. It's been replicated so many times. The Connecticut Supreme Court said, pursuant to our supervisory power, if you do not give this warning, right, the next time you show photos, we're going to give an instruction to the jury that, you know, procedure was used, that increases the chance of an erroneous identification. You should take that into consideration when you're putting the evidence in the case. And the reason I think that's so important, and I think will increasingly be done, is that that has a real deterrent effect. I think that, you know, police are going to want to engage in best practices if the jury's going to get a charge. Now, a lot of trial lawyers say juries don't listen to instructions anyhow. But we all think they do, right? We all are fighting over the instructions, and all the appeals were about the instructions, so we care about that, but that's what we can control. So the variables, the system variables that we can control, we should. And we should find in the most scientific and appropriate ways which ones work.
The reason I'm asking really in terms of maybe there should be an instruction to the jury in every case concerning eyewitness identification.
Well, there are general instructions. You have the healthcare instruction here in the cases. There are some general instructions about the dangers of eyewitness identification. The famous one is the healthcare instruction. It's called on the one hand, on the other hand.
I'm not sure how much those work. My own view of this, incidentally, is that the more we know about factors that are related to error, you know, scientifically related to error, and people don't follow those instructions, please don't follow those instructions, jury should know about it. Because you go back and look at the case law in this area, starting with Neil B. Biggers and Manson versus Breakaway, the way that the courts have addressed this is they say, okay, we're going to look and see if there was an unduly suggestive identification procedure. Now we're going to look at a series of reliability factors, opportunity to observe, certainty at the time of the identification, amount of attention to pay, the differences between the characteristics of the suspect and the description, right, the kind of the description. And these are the reliability factors are balanced, and only if there's a substantial probability of an irreparable misidentification will either the out-of-court identification or the in-court identification be suppressed. So how many times does that happen? Never, okay? Virtually never. Even in instances where there might have been a lot of undue suggestion. One of the fascinating findings is that the reliability factors are falsely inflated by suggestion. One of the most powerful studies that you'll see is one that was done of confirming feedback. And that is, at the time of the identification, if you tell the witness, yeah, that's right, you were looking for that guy, that's right. Even though the studies show again and again, if you show them, they have, you know, one of these films and they make identifications and you do all these identification procedures with them, that's how they do these experiments. But if you tell the witness, yeah, you know, we think that's the guy, all of a sudden, later, when you make an inquiry of them, they have their certainty rises, a false sense of certainty. They think they had a better opportunity to observe than they really did. They think they were paying more attention than they really were. I mean, that's what the experiment showed. Confirming feedback is a very, very important factor. So the reliability factors can be increased by the undue suggestion, which makes this kind of a mess. So I suspect that what's going to be happening, just as police departments begin to adopt those best practices that are generally accepted, which we can do, Sarah, in turn, I think if those practices are not followed, I think courts will eventually instruct jury design, particularly when there's a satisfying basis.
How do you get away from the confirming thing, though, when a person is going to a lineup, and then they're called in to testify at trial?
Absolutely.
That's just kind of bingo.
Absolutely. And that's there's no question that some confirming feedback is absolutely inevitable because they pick that guy out and now we're going to a trial. So that's inherent in the process. But what they do find, right, in studies, that if you say right away, great job, that's our guy, it really tends to recap with the witness. That's why you just have to see it. That's why it's good if the examiner is the one. Right? So you can't say right away, that's the guy, because for all you know, it's a filler. Now, I should mention one other thing about the laptop experiments. One of the experiments, remember I described that you're going to do a certain 150 sequential blind identifications versus 150 simultaneous blind identifications. However, we want to do one set of experiments, and we're going to do in Dallas to do this, because we discussed it with Jim Gordon, where there'll be something called double blind versus computer blind. And that is one group where the officers are, you know, the person who administered doesn't know the suspect at all, and another one where the officer takes the laptop out and stands behind the computer while the witness does the identification. So because it's all randomly assigned, the officer doesn't know, you know, which number the suspect is. Just ask the question from the other side of the computer, and it can be, you know, videotaped or audiotaped. And the reason that that's very, very important is it actually tests another variable that a lot of people worry about. Many police officers believe, well, you know, one of the things that, one of the reasons we don't like a blind administration is that we develop a rapport with the witness. And so witnesses may be intimidated or afraid to make an identification, so it's important that I'm in the room with my witness. Now, I don't think anybody can seriously contend that it's important that you also be in the room with the witness and also tell who to pick. That we don't want, right? So what's great about this computer blind versus double blind experiment is that we actually will be able to do some testing about rapport and its effects. Because if the computer blind situation, the officer has a rapport with the witness and knows the witness, right? So we'll be able to take a look at computer blind versus double blind and get some sense of how much rapport matters in terms of the witness's ability to make an identification, willingness to make an identification, and accuracy. So that's one of the things that we want to conduct.
And I have two questions. One of them, I was wondering if identifying marks or tattoos or piercings are ever used in lieu of a facial identification or conjunction with them. And also, if you all have studied if people of the same race are better at identifying in a lineup the actual suspect of their own race as opposed to people from another race within the same lineup.
Let me take the second one first. There's an enormous amount of study on that question about the problems of cross-race identification. I think the last thing in the ADA Journal, there's a whole article about it, and I'm really considering that in New York in those 2 weeks, adopting something on the instruction. It's very interesting because the data shows that people of the majority race, right, and this incidentally, we do this in Africa, where the population is black and you're talking about white. But people of the majority race are worse at identifying people in minorities. And so that is a factor. One of the interesting things about it is that it doesn't seem to matter whether the individual involved has a lot of exposure to the minority. So, you know, somebody that works in an inner city school is white, an inner city school is people that are black or brown. They ain't any better in these experiments than the person who doesn't have much contact with the minority community. Minorities are somewhat better than the majority community in making cross-racial identifications, but it is a problem, and there are, in many states, and certainly in the scientific literature, suggested jury instructions. That's what the ADA is taking up. What jury instruction would be appropriate about cross-racial identification? The other point you make is a great one, actually. And one of the factors that we're looking at when we do those outcome studies to see with these field experiments is one of the factors that one would take into consideration about whether an ID is reliable or not is if there was some, you know, particular mark. Like my favorite example was the Elliot Spitzer tattoo that was right over here on the left neck of the assailant. And then you find a guy that has an Elliot Spitzer tattoo. You don't know our governor of New York, remember our governor? When we lost the U.S., he was brought with the prostitute, the Elliot Spitzer tattoo. But I do think that that is actually, yes, I've seen cases today where the witness can't identify the person, but can identify some peculiar characteristic.
So is that apart from the lineup that's presented to them, or will they say in the process, well, I can't figure out anyone here, but I do know this, and then they're shown multiple pictures of different identifying marks to choose from? Or do they go directly based on what the person said?
How do you create a tattoo lineup? Those are the following people. It's a very interesting point.
Can't they superimpose them on them? I've seen
them. Well, they can. No, that's happened. Yeah. And what they try to do is eliminate them sometimes. You know, like they saw the tattoo, they're over a corporeal lamp, or they're asking about cover it up. You raise an interesting point.
I appreciate the way you're controlling for your variables. How do you control for the fact that you're 150 units would not have had a difference of finding the appropriate individual without one being sequential, without being that? I mean, controlling the groups at the onset.
Right. Well, that's where the random assignment is.
The random assignment at 150, is that a large enough N?
Well, yeah, but we're doing it in five jurisdictions.
Okay. So your assumption is that even if they've all been the same way, they've been the same way.
Right, and that's why random assignments, because it's a little bit more problematic if you're going to break it up and say, okay, we're going to do, you know, this week we're going to do non-blind, you know, and we do 100, and then next week we're going to do this, and next week we're going to do that, and it's not randomly assigned. We can tend to get, you know, artifactual effects.
We're not even going to get right for clear.
Well, you never know. Because that's one of the problems here. That's why we're doing the outcome study, and we want to emphasize that even in this outcome study, it's not ground truth. We're never going to get to ground truth in these cases. But at least we have a more finely grained understanding as to whether the suspect pick has a lot of other evidence that tends to corroborate strong identification, or that the, you know, it, or the dismissal could be a strong identification. So we want to get that kind of data to inform an assessment of outcomes.
Just going back to the question that was raised earlier about the inevitability of the confirming feedback, you didn't mention the importance of the documentation and certainty statement in that context, which I think when we're asking jurors to assess the quality of the testimony, what's missing too often is that context about the actual identification procedure. So it seems like documentation is the way to get
that's why that's why everybody says a certainty statement. And incidentally, that's what Manson says. In other words, if you go back and you look at the reliability factors, they say certainty at the time of the identification, because so much gets skewed afterwards by what you've learned, right? And as somebody that's dealt with these cases for a long time, it's not unusual for somebody to say, I think that's the guy. And then by the time they're testifying, I'll never forget that face in 100 years. And for good reason, because, you know, they heard me attack 10 other people in the neighborhood. So, of course, I'm sure. Or their neighbor said, yeah, that's right. And that's what makes these cases difficult. So that's why that certainty statement in the words of the witness is a very good best practice.
Have you seen any time, any data that shows the closer to the event, the better the eyewitness?
Absolutely. There's, and you know by the gaps, that if you actually look at the curve from memory, it drops pretty substantially. That's why there have been studies, Yarmy and Yarmy, I did studies of show-ups, right? And we all know that show-ups are inherently suggestive identification procedure. And they shouldn't be unduly suggestive. I mean, there's ways of doing them that are not as bad as others. But they still have some reliability because it's right after the incident. It has to be prompt. So that rule, of course, of devise has been vindicated by some of the scientific studies. Although I must say that we're in an era now where you saw the laptop, we're not far from the PDA, right? You know, you go right out, you get the guy that meets the description, take a photo, right? And then you go online and you download all the other photos, you know, you put in the description, right? You get other photos and you make your photo array right there on the street. You can do it in 10 minutes. I have to tell you, because all this is going to change, that's why it's so good to have, to try to get the courts and the police and the prosecutors and everybody involved in looking at the science as we evolve. I'll tell you how they do it in Great Britain, which is quite fascinating. In Great Britain now, the way they do the photos is 180 degrees. So they do like a video photo of somebody. You look straight ahead, you do that for 10 seconds, then you slowly move this way, back, move this way. So you get a full, you know, sort of three-dimensional look. So they do that for all their mugshots, essentially, right? And then when they pick somebody up, they have a group that goes right to the scene and does one of these video things. So when they make their presentations, they do a sequential blind presentation with these 180-degree things. Okay? So, I mean, you know, who would have believed when I got into this business in 1988 by accidentally getting involved with the DNA at the very beginning? It's believe me, Peter and I knew nothing about this stuff. We just had a case, we tried to use the technology, and, you know, got educated by 11 people. I never thought that we'd be in this, you know, this is an extraordinary time. And the change is just unbelievable, isn't it?
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.